Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm glad you could make it. I'm actually pretty excited today to get the chance to tell you about an experiment that we actually envision as a very long-term experiment, but today I can tell you about some of the initial results from a study that's going to look at the movement of carbon from wood into soil carbon pools. And ultimately, we hope follow it from very many years and see where it ends up in the soil and which type of soil carbon fractions it ends up in. There should be quite a bit of interest in what happens to woody carbon inputs, because things are happening that are actually changing wood carbon inputs to the soil surface quite a bit. In the eastern U.S., the federal forests, for instance, aren't harvested as intensively as they once were. If you do that, then you get more tree growth, more competition, more self-thinning. That's more wood carbon entering the soil surface. We've seen a trend for an increase in certain types of disturbance events. Now, this is actually one of my research sites where we had a 100 or 200-year windstorm type event, right? Nothing seen for very many years, and a bunch of trees went down, and that actually happened regionally. We had a lot of severe storms, a lot of trees coming down, a lot of woody debris entering the soil system. In the east, we have insect and pest diseases, beech bark disease, emerald ash borer. That's killing trees. Got a lot of trees in the area. Maybe you do a salvage harvest. A lot of times, these species are scattered individuals. That's going to be dead wood entering the soil surface. Certainly insect issues out in western forests, lots of dead wood being created. In some cases, that leads to a lot of fire hazard and high fuel loads. But even treatments designed to deal with high fuel loads can cause inputs of wood carbon to the soil. If you masticate and have chips that you spread or incorporate, that's wood carbon entering the soil. So there should be quite a bit of interest as to what happens to wood carbon when it enters the soil. So one of the biggest questions is wood gets to the soil surface. Now, how much of that is going to ultimately end up in the soil, and where in the soil will it end up, versus how much just ends up decomposing and going back to the atmosphere as CO2? One of the biggest issues is, can you differentiate carbon from the wood from carbon from other sources, such as root and leaf litter, especially as it becomes more decomposed, say mineral-associated carbon, how do you know what it came from? So ideally, you would have wood that had an isotopic trace that you could follow. Now, you can make isotopically labeled leaf litter pretty easily. You could do that in a year. But if you want to deal with wood, especially large pieces of wood, now you've got all these multiple years of growth rings, you'd like to label them all. So you've got to grow wood in a labeled CO2 environment for many years. Through photosynthesis, get that uniformly into the wood. Who's going to pay you to do that, right? Really expensive to do that. Well, guess what? Somebody's already paid for it. They weren't intending to create isotopically labeled wood, but they did. So the FACE studies created that. They were designed to look at the impacts of a future elevated atmospheric CO2 on ecosystem processes. So they grew trees in these rings outside under ambient conditions and also under elevated CO2 conditions, right? The future atmosphere. And to create that future atmosphere, what's going on right here becomes real important. That's where the CO2 trucks would come in one a day to provide the CO2 to create the elevated CO2 environment in the elevated CO2 treatment. This is the Aspen FACE site in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Well, that CO2 that came in on these trucks had a fossil fuel source. So that CO2 was depleted in 13C. So that got mixed with ambient CO2. To create the elevated CO2 inside the FACE rings, which means the trees then were growing in this isotopically depleted CO2 environment. So they picked that up in all of their tissue parts. So you certainly can see it in the wood that was created. At the Aspen FACE site, for instance, it's 14 per mil more depleted than the control wood. So FACE sites are done now. The experiments have ended on the main ones that involve trees. This one was harvested in 2009, and I ended up in charge of that harvest, unfortunately, actually, because Dave Kronowski passed away in 2008. But that 2009 harvest was the scientific experimental harvest. It looked in detail at the different components of the trees and in the soil below ground to look at the carbon and nutrients and where everything was. And that was just done on subplots, not on all the trees on the main plot. So that brings us to the Northwoods winter of 2010. So bear with me, we've got a placer going here. So we have the experimental science harvest in the summer. Winter of 2010, I was also in charge of the, hey, we want to use our research site for something else and get your trees off of it harvest to take the rest of the trees off. So we're harvesting these trees. I know they've got this isotopic signature. I don't just want to discard them. We're really swamped, busy with all kinds of other stuff. But we have coffee every Friday morning. And at the Michigan Tech ESC Friday morning coffees, I was talking to Marty Jurgensen, one of my co-authors here today, saying, Marty, I've got all this wood. It's isotopically depleted. It'd be great. You could track the wood carbon into the soil. He thought, that's a great idea. So he started talking to other people. All right? Marty knows lots of people, right? So he's talking to Carl Trenton and Felipe Sanchez, and I think at some point Ram Oren got involved. They thought, this is a great idea, and let's even see if we can get wood from the Duke Face site, and they could. So the end result of all of this was the birth of the Face Wood Decomposition Experiment. And far and away the most credit for this actually happening, getting started and getting as far along as it has, goes to Carl Trenton, who's also one of my co-authors today. And he's here in the room as well. So the Face Wood Decomposition Experiment took wood from these two face sites and deployed it at 9 experimental forests across the U.S. that have a wide range of natural environmental conditions and soil types and natural forest types as well. So in 2011, this actually happened, right? Wood from the aspen, birch, and loblolly pine logs from the aspen face site and Duke face site was deployed as horizontal logs. And we also deployed some of the loblolly pine logs as vertical logs to kind of simulate snags. And today, just to keep within the 15-minute time limit, I'll only talk about the horizontal logs. But if you want to know what's going on so far with the vertical logs, just ask me afterward. There you see at the beginning of the experiment what some of the loblolly pine logs look like. So the experiment's been going since 2011 now. And some initial samples on wood mass loss and fungal community attacking wood and that were made in 2013. Another sampling occurred in 2015. And there are multiple objectives for this sampling, so just the ones that kind of highlighted in yellow are the parts that I'll be talking about today, which is the incorporation of that wood carbon into the mineral soil carbon, so seeing that wood carbon move into the mineral soil. And I'll have just a little bit on termites as well, because some of the sites have termites and some of the sites don't. Keep in mind, these 9 sites, they vary a lot in their conditions. For instance, mean annual precipitation ranges from 200 to 1,615 millimeters. Mean annual temperature from just above freezing at the Fraser site to 18 degrees C is the average mean annual temperature at the Santee site in South Carolina. And again, some of the sites have termites, some don't. There's variations in the soils among the sites, variations in the forest communities as well. So right on to results. So this is one of the sites you expect a high rate of decomposition, right? Warm and moist, the Santee site in South Carolina. It's a warm, moist location. And the way to interpret these figures is to kind of look at the control area, which is soil sampled from beneath no log at all. This is the native soil. This is the 13C signature at different soil depths. And we sampled by 2 centimeter depths down to 6 centimeters and then took one more sample from 6 to 10 centimeters as well. So if you look at the control, anything more negative than that, and I put the negative numbers higher on these graphs just because higher looks like you can actually see it. So if you get above that line for the similar soil depth for the control, that's face wood carbon entering the soil pool. That's what's causing that signature to become more negative. So you see for all three of the species under the horizontal logs, we definitely were seeing face wood move into the soil. And if we look the next soil increment down, we still see it. In fact, at the Santee site, we're kind of seeing it in all the different soil layers we sampled. It ends up being 11% of the soil carbon in the top 10 centimeters under the aspen actually came from the aspen log. And it's like 7% for the birch and 6% for the pine. Well, how about colder sites, or sites with slower decomposition? Well, Fraser's our coldest site in Colorado. Mean annual temperature barely above freezing. But even there, we're seeing face wood carbon moving into the soil. Not as much. It's about 2% of the soil carbon beneath the aspen log in the top 10 centimeters came from the aspen log, and about 4 and 4.5% for the birch and pine. But it's moving down into the soil. At the 7 different sites, or at the 9 different sites, we see the face wood carbon clearly moving into the soil, the mineral soil pools, in 7 of the sites, and a hint that it's moving in the other 2 sites, but it's not significant yet. And actually now where you do have a log, you don't, of course, you don't get litter inputs right below the log anymore. So we see the forest floor going down, but what's left of the forest floor when we sample that, and I'm not showing that here, but when we do sample what's left of the forest floor, there's a lot of facewood carbon in that layer as well. So we look across all the sites. You kind of see as we lose wood mass more quickly, so wood density loss gets greater, we tend to see an increase in the fraction of soil carbon that is from facewood. So right now, in the early stages of decomposition, just the rate of mass loss above ground is fairly well correlated with the rate of facewood carbon movement into the soil as well. And if we look at the different species, we tend to see the pine and the aspen kind of following the same trend, and maybe not as much birch. And we still have to look into detail to try to figure out why that is. Does it mean more of the birch carbon ends up to the atmosphere, or is it because the birch logs tended to be a little smaller as well? So right now, that's why we don't see as much in the soil, because there just wasn't as much mass above to move in. That's the next set of calculations I have to do, which will get pretty complicated because I have to look log by log at this now to actually figure out the reverse of this. This is how much of the soil carbon came from the wood. The reverse will be how much of the wood carbon can you find in the soil. And then you have to take into account the size of each individual log, and it'll get a little more complicated. I said we'd talk a little bit about termites. At the Santee site in South Carolina, Carl set up a termite exclusion experiment. So this guy really thinks of good ideas, let me tell you. So 49 meter squared plots, 7 by 7, dug all the way down to the clay subsoil and installed a screen mesh that the termites cannot penetrate around that. Use cellulosic baits to kind of trap the termites within the exclusion plot. I kept putting those out until you found no more termites, and even now, since then, still keep baits out there to make sure no termites get in. So we deployed, or Carl deployed, a few of the loblolly pine logs within the termite exclusion plots as well, and in adjacent control areas. Although in this case, the control area has termites, so keep that in mind. Control has termites, exclusion does not. So we look at there. So we have two controls. In this case, it's a second control. This is control with no log. So where termites are excluded, we have a control area and logs, and that's in the non-screened-in area. And where termites, I'm sorry, that's within the screened-in area. Where the termites are present, that's outside the exclusion plots. And again, there's samples taken from not beneath a log and from beneath a decomposing log. So in both cases, you see facewood carbon moving into the soil, but where termites are present, not as much is moving, as where termites are excluded. About twice as much of the facewood carbon was moving into the mineral soil where the termites are excluded. So why is there less where we have termites present? And that's a question there's a couple of theories, and we're going to do further work to try to figure that out. It could mean where termites are present, more of it is actually going to the atmosphere as CO2, so less is going into the soil. It could be termites are moving this stuff around. So when you sample right under the log, you don't find it. It's spread out more. So we're actually going to go back and put some new logs out and actually maybe set up some new termite exclusion plots as well at a couple other sites where we'll look at the CO2 and methane coming off the logs and from the surrounding soil right from the beginning, so we can see if it's going out to the atmosphere. And we'll do not just sample under the log, but kind of a spatial sampling under the log, out from the log a little bit, and deeper to see if that carbon is somewhere else that the termites have moved it. So 4 years into this study, the facewood was clearly detectable in the soil as a more negative delta 13C, significant at 7 of the 9 sites. The amount of facewood in soil carbon was positively correlated with the initial mass loss of the overlying logs. So at least the initial movement is controlled by the decomposition of the logs. Less wood carbon tended to end up as soil carbon for birch and for aspen and loblolly pine, and less wood carbon ended up as soil carbon when termites were present. We've got a lot of ongoing research. One of the next things is to look at the soil carbon fractions. We're going to use density fractionation on samples from 2015 and also samples to be taken next year to see which carbon fractions this wood carbon is actually ending up in. Dan Lindner has always been looking at the fungal community, and he'll be doing that again in the 2017 sampling. That tells us who's present. We also want to know what their function is. So Jonathan Schilling's group is using a carbohydrate selectivity method to figure out the dominant decomposition pathway. So we'll kind of look at the carbohydrates left in the wood, figure out what's been removed, and from that you can kind of tell where you are in a white rot to brown rot spectrum. And Xiahua Dai is going to develop a wood decomposition model for the forest DNDC model. So a lot going on. And we do have the year 6 wood and soil sampling happening this summer. So lots of other opportunities. We want to view this as like a community experiment and invite others to come in and collaborate with us. So talk to me or Marty or Carl. I think we'll be here all day, maybe after the town hall tonight. People are interested to get together with us. You know, we're looking for collaborators. There's far more that could be done with this site than we can do. It's a unique opportunity. Creating the face wood at the Aspen site costs the DOE $10 million in CO2 and infrastructure. This is not going to happen again. So we want to take full advantage of this experiment. So please approach us. We want really, you know, everyone who's interested to get involved. And with that, I'll take any questions you have.
One question?
Just how far do termites travel in general? Is it a long distance, or is it going to stay pretty close to the source?
I don't think we really know that yet, and they're not, the travel isn't uniform. So I was asking Carl kind of the same question, to talk about, well, they can travel pretty far, not super far, but they kind of concentrate on where they're, these are all subterranean, kind of concentrate on where their nests are and that. So to actually find where they're moving the soil carbon, it may take a little bit of effort. So one of the first things as we try to further figure out what's going on with the termites would be to see, is it just leaving CO2 and methane? And if it's not there, then we hopefully can find it as we sample around the logs. But they could distribute it so widely that we can't. So we have two places we hope to find it. If we don't, then the third possibility that's being really widely distributed is kind of all that's left.